his wife's love and affection. Okay? But let's say that he somehow could let that on through, and then it hit his self-perception then. How is he going to interpret it here now? If he feels unloved, unaccepted, unholy, impatient, worthless, failure, guilty, stupid, and boring, how's he going to interpret it there? Well, it could make him more guilty. Because now, look at the way I've been treating her. And she's coming and giving me this big hug and this big kiss and everything else. And look at all that I did the other day. Look at all that we were going through just the other day or yesterday or 5 minutes ago or whatever. And so now he's starting to feel guilty. And what he does is, see, he's still not receiving it. He's still keeping it away. See what I'm saying? So these filters can really filter out the very thing that we want. So now our spouse gets locked out. Not even their love is good anymore. Because I doubt it. I think they're trying to control and manipulate me. And not only that, I feel so bad about myself, they couldn't mean that. They'd have to be brain dead to say that about me. Because they know what I'm like. At my worst, right? Okay? So that's when the old identity, those old things are in play. Now, I'm going to put up a pie in the sky overhead, okay? I understand it's pie in the sky. So if you just kind of look at how those filters could interact at some point, kind of gives you some hope, doesn't it? That if I'm loved, accepted, holy, patient, joyful, truthful, kind, gentle, faithful, well, you notice it's the same in all of them. And as we walk in the Lord and look at those relational filters, then I can begin to say, oh, okay. And when my wife is in the flesh or walks after the flesh, then it shouldn't really have to affect me all that much. Now here's a problem. Is when you come back here, and you remember the one that's walking this way? They're beginning to trust who they are in Christ, and they're not going to let those feelings control them anymore. Well, this guy, he's saying, I love you, and the woman's walking with the Lord, and he's really secure in the Lord. Now, that happens, you know, it may be a minute-by-minute thing. Okay? You're not saying it's that way all the time, and what? But she's beginning to walk this way. Now, what do you think job does this man take upon himself? He's saying, this is too good to be true. Let me see if I can resurrect the flesh. This really happens. And so they get over there and they're pushing all these old buttons, trying to get her to act the way she used to act and get her trying to do all the mean things. You know why? Because now he doesn't have an excuse for all his bad behavior and feelings. So he's trying to control her. He's trying to push all these buttons because he wants to see if he can resurrect the old gal. Let's see if I can get that going again. I need an excuse for staying and living in my sinful ways. So I've got to resurrect it over here. Push button, push button, push button. So here's an interesting thing. When you see one spouse get right with the Lord, the other spouse goes nuts. In other words, their behavior can go wild. Because they're trying to resurrect in their spouse the old person. Now that seems totally insane because they wanted them to change anyway. Understand? Do you get a picture of the insanity of all this stuff? It is total insanity is what it is. And we're so caught in it, we don't realize it many times. So that's why one of the diagrams that you do have, by the way, in this section is as I look at an issue then, if I approach the issue, I think it's the second or third page in the section in section E, as I approach the issue, I have a tendency to approach an issue to prove what the other person is. Okay? So when there's an issue, something comes up, maybe how about how we spend money? We spend too much money, we don't have enough money. Whatever the thing is, raising the kids, disciplining the kids, it doesn't make any difference what the issue is. But what you'll see that the husband will try to he'll try to legitimize what he feels or thinks about his wife already. So he uses the issue to try to prove that here's what his wife really is unloving. She really is insensitive. She really is a nag. And she tries to prove that he really is selfish, that he really is controlling. You know, he really is whatever, moody, etc. And so they use each issue to try to prove it to each other, what they already feel about themselves. Now, where is that going to get you? You know, that wasn't the issue in the first place. We just want to have a little discussion on whether we should spend $20 on this or $50 on that item. That's the issue. But now it turns into a great heated argument. Now, one of the things that we like to do is we like to begin to, and before we do that, I just want to take a, I want to go back to this one just a minute to show you another way that the issue comes into play. Sometimes when we start discussing the issue, what would it mean for the man, if you will, to be wrong? Wouldn't it prove that he's stupid, maybe guilty, maybe failure, worthless, unloved, unaccepted, if he was wrong? That may prove that, you know, she's pushing real hard for her way. It really proves to him that women are controlling, demanding, selfish, so on and so on. And all of a sudden now he doesn't have the right to be wrong because he's trying to protect himself, his pride, if you will, his identity. And he's tying into what women are really like at their worst. Now that's not the issue. The issue is, should we have spaghetti tonight or pizza? You know, it could be something as simple as that. But all of a sudden it's a major blowout. If I don't get my way, I can't be wrong. And the same thing with her if she's still in the walking after the flesh here. See what I'm saying? So now we're not talking about the issue anymore. We're trying to protect an identity that's not ours. Now that's a plan, isn't it? Well, I'm going to protect this identity who I'm really not and really argue about it. Well, that's a good plan. So the other way then to approach the issue, we feel, is to approach the issue from desire. You know, most of the time when we do counseling stuff, I'll ask the woman, I says, well, tell me, when push comes to shove, when you're down, whatever, what is your deepest desire? What would you really, truly, 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 truly like? What do you really desire for your life? Well, and here's what it goes like. Well, I really desire to be intimate with God. That's my deepest desire. I really desire to be a godly woman. I really desire to be a godly wife. I really desire to be a godly mother. I really desire to have a godly home. You know, home that's comfortable for people. I really desire to be a good witness at work, if she happens to work outside of the home. Okay? These are desires. Now, I'm going to ask you this question. What's wrong with those desires? Is there anything wrong with them? Okay. Now, what's interestingly, when you talk to the believer husband, guess what his is? Pretty much the same thing. So all you have to do is write a repeat of that. Then they vary a little bit. But what I found is that most people, when they look at their deepest desires, they're holy. They're right. Now, what if they both approached the issue, whether I said $50 or $20 on a particular item, what if they approached it from their desire? They began to look at each other's and each other's desires and give them the benefit of the doubt. Now, wouldn't that make a difference on how they approach that decision? And they're not trying to prove that the other person is trying to be in control and manipulating and all this other kind of stuff. Yeah, it does make a difference. It makes a big difference. Okay? Dick. Not one of those questions, Dick. I saw this smile already. No, go ahead. Yeah, we're right back here again. Yet I said, so now what are you trying to do? You know, and so some of you were present when Mike gave that analogy. He used a similar illustration. I think he used this illustration about the woman who went on and on about her husband. She, even though he wants to be a godly man, well, they wouldn't act that way. And he does this, 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 this. Next thing you know, she was in there. And Mike said, that's it. I've had it. You remember that? He walked over, got this big Zulu knife, and walked behind him. And she's going, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? He said, well, I've had it with this guy. He doesn't deserve to live. You know. He said, you convinced me. Well, you know, that was a counseling technique, but no. That's a rage therapy is what we call it. But see, yeah, you're right, because people, they get right back into it. And that's the thing. Is they get into it so quickly, it takes them a while to get out of that bad habit of doing that. But you had to say now, you know, it's really interesting, is that I know you've counseled people like that, but, you know, sometimes you've got a husband or wife that accuses their husband or wife of being unfaithful to them. You get the guy or the gal alone and said, have you ever been unfaithful to him? No, I really haven't. But you know, over the last 10 years, I started to think about it. You know? So you accuse somebody so long, so long, so long, so long, you continually plant the thought in their head. Then, you know, that's sometimes what we're trying to do, is why would we want our spouse to stay there? Let's mention it all the time. Now, the one thing that's really helped me, just in my own marriage, is to understand that my spouse's inability to change is the same as my inability to change. Should I say that again? Her inability to make the changes that I think she should make are the same as my inability to make the changes that I know she thinks I should make. So sometimes she says, you should change here, and I go, yes, I think I should change there. Now tell me how to do it. I don't know. How you do that? I said, now you got my dilemma, right? I really would like to change in that area. So let's go before the Lord. And so once I understood that her inability to change was the same as my inability to change, then we could come together in agreement. If you learn how to do this, give me the secret, okay? Because our changes are different, you know. I don't understand why she just can't remember the little things that please me. Well, she's a feeler. Now, that doesn't excuse her, but that's difficult for her to do. I can understand why I've made maybe between 7 and 10 house keys in the last... We've only lived there a little over a year. Now, it shouldn't be that difficult to keep track of a house key, should it? Probably every neighbor in two blocks of us has one. You know, I don't know where they're all at, but somehow the house key monster gets them, and they're gone, you know. In fact, we got one of these nice little alarm things that you can carry with you and pull the pin and it makes real loud noise. Well, you know, we lost that. I got that for her to be safe. Well, she's really safe. She's lost that. Yeah, we lost that somewhere. But we did find it the other day. So anyway, you know, I would like to say, well, why don't you just pick up, you know, don't get to have the pile disease and don't lose your keys. And so every time she says, honey, I can't find my keys, can I borrow yours? I just hand them over in fear and trepidation. And for some reason, she doesn't lose my keys. Okay, she's been very good at that. By the way, I do the same thing with Mike. Because I never know if I'm ever going to get those back. So we can, you know, her inability to change that little quirk about her is the same as my inability to sometimes just forget something and let it go, because I'm a thinker and let things, I think, and rehash. And she says, why don't you just let it go? Well, okay. I could. You know, and then that's when I start saying, it's just about as easy as you keeping track of keys. And she goes, oh, well, forget that then. That's pretty hard, isn't it? And I said, yeah, that's right. Let's take about a 5-minute break and we'll continue on. General, that's what I said. You know, in general, so, you know, get some of those characteristics, you know, not as strong as, or, you know, whatever they may be. And so you can actually take in some of those things too. So it doesn't just have to be parents, and it doesn't, you know, some of mine have to do with sisters. I had two older sisters. They'll be good to know. I have to send them this tape, how they influenced my life. You cross them and they chased you all over the farm. So, you know, you didn't mess with them too much. So I can remember some of those things. So it doesn't just have to be, you know, mothers, and it doesn't have to be wives. It can be sisters. It can be ex-girlfriends. Or current girlfriends or something, you know, it can be any of those people, culture, and so forth and so on. So that goes into there. But here's one that's kind of, there's another one in here that's kind of dangerous that I look for, and that's a descriptor. What if the girl has a descriptor that he'll never change? Now that's kind of a dangerous one. You know why?
Because even if she does change, she won't believe it.
Because even if she does, she won't believe it.
And she'll
treat him as if she's not. So whatever he does, see, I've seen this in husbands and wives who've tried to convert their husbands or wives for, you know, 12, 13, 14 years. And then all of a sudden, they give up. Well, he's unconvertible, you know, or inconvertible, or not a convertible. I don't know. He's one of those things. And so she goes off and leaves him alone, and guess what happens? He's not busy reacting to her now. The Lord gets his attention, he gets saved. But see, she has in her filter that he'll never change, so what does she say to herself? You just wait and see. He'll be back to his old games. A year later, you just wait and see. He'll be back to his old... Now, how many years is it going to take? So, meanwhile, I was counseling with it in one situation where she said he'll never change. So, she went out and found herself, even though she was married to him, she went out and found herself another man. Now, does she have a vested interest now that he does not change? Now, she's got a vested interest that he not change. Because she's having an affair with somebody else. And so now she will not let him change. Because if she admits that he changes, then she's going to have to give up her fella and repent and do a bunch of other things. So he'll never change can be a really, really hard one. And by the way, whenever you work with any kind of a spousal type of a thing, the one that never gets put up there but is almost always true is that they're dangerous. Now, you marry the most dangerous person on the face of the earth to you. The reason is they can hurt you the most. Right? Can't that person hurt you the most? So sometimes with a young husband and young wife, they're trying to really get to know each other and stuff, but meanwhile they're trying to stay away so they don't get hurt. This really makes for a close relationship. So they're not going to be vulnerable, but they're trying to be intimate. Now that is kind of an oxymoron, paradox, or whatever they call that. It doesn't fit. A conundrum. Is that right, Verlaine? A conundrum. That's our, Verlaine, my new word for the week. What is it? Conundrum. Yeah. I have to say it a bit much. It's a conundrum. Oh boy. Okay, those are some things. Now, relational filters. So it's important to begin to deal with these things. Now, part of what we're looking at then is what Mike basically calls the marriage spiral. Now, here's where we're going to kind of head with this. You remember seeing this diagram that Mike shared, Journey to the End of Self? There's a point where we come under conviction to be saved. We get saved, and then it seems like the Lord puts us in a process where we carry along our little bag of tricks of how we got our needs met apart from the Lord. And then we find ourselves, in essence, going downhill, and then we try to regain that salvation, if you will, and we come down here and we keep going down further and further and further until finally we come to a point where I'm convicted of my weakness, where I say, I can't. And if I can't, who can? Christ can. So we come to a point where I come to a point where my idols don't work for me anymore. I become aware of them. And a lot of people say, well, what are those idols? Well, that's box D and E on that chart. Okay? That's some of those things, if you want to go back to that. So you see, and so then you have brothers and sisters in Christ come along and try to help you stay up there. And finally come to a point where saying, Lord, I can't do it. If you're going to live the Christian life, you're going to have to do it yourself. With my, you know, I want to help, but I'm blowing everything. I thought I was trying to do it, and I just can't handle life anymore. And the Lord says, that's okay. And then you kind of see more something like this, where we begin to grow. You're not trusting your idols, you're trusting the Lord. And what's really kind of scary is when we look at actions, the actions can be the same on the left side as they are on the right side. Right? So what are some of the actions we try here? Well, it can be Bible reading, prayer, church attendance, Bible study, all these things I tried, but on the other side I'm doing the very same things, aren't I? Yeah. And so, but in one sense, God's bringing me to a point of saying, I can't live the Christian life in and of myself. I can't deal with the woman that thou hast given me. I can't deal with the kids that thou hast given me. I can't deal with the dog that thou hast given me. And you come to that point and say, I'm just going to have to trust you to give me what I need in the moment because I just can't make it. And the Lord says, okay, I can do that. And so we start to learn to walk and abide in Him. That's the faith walk, if you will. Okay? I've been trying the sight things. They don't work. I'm trying the faith walk and they do work. Well, one of the things then, in a marriage relationship then, since we have the journey to the end of yourself, we like to share this little diagram, journey to the end of your marriage. Okay? This is not a real popular diagram. It's not the one people say, please send us that. Let's just take a gal and a guy, and they marry and they get, of course, if God's purpose for them, just like here in the journey to the end of themselves, is to come to them to the end of themselves. When you're married, you're going to the end of yourself. Who do you take with you? Yeah, you bet. So you both head on down this path. And the interesting thing is you're both looking to each other then. At this point, you're looking to each other to meet each other's needs. And that has to do with what we just got done looking at, where you're pushing each other buttons, and you're the description of some of those kinds of marriages is they're getting more and more miserable all the time. And you know what the number one purpose of marriage is? To make you miserable. That's the number one purpose of marriage. The number two purpose of marriage is to bring joy and happiness. Now here's why we say that. People have trouble with that. Who better can raise the flesh to the surface than your spouse? Right? So you get married, and they raise, if you will, I'm talking about biblical flesh to the surface. I'm not talking about peeling your shirt off. It's raise that biblical flesh to the surface. Self-centered, selfish, meet my needs my way, all this kinds of stuff. And he comes to the surface. Now, what's God's plan for flesh? He's out to kill it. And so God uses our spouse uniquely to draw our flesh to the surface so that he can kill it. That's why we say the number one purpose of marriage is to be miserable. Because when your flesh rises to the top, you're miserable. You're really miserable. But when the Lord comes in and you deal with the flesh, then what happens? Joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. All those things begin to happen and you really sit back and enjoy it. And it can become a very enjoyable relationship. So I'm talking here at the misery stage. Not Missouri, but misery. Misery stage. And you're headed down to coming to the end of the marriage. And when I'm saying the end of marriage, I'm not saying divorce. Where you come to a point where you say, I can't do it. I can't live with this woman that thou hast given me. I cannot do it. I can't love her. I can't this and that. And the Lord says, well, good. And I can. And I do. So you're going to step back and let me love her now? The way that I've always wanted to through you? So you might want to say that this couple starts off then with a lot of self-love. Okay? They start out with a lot of self-love. And it's kind of like, you know, someone described it as two ticks getting married. They're trying to suck each other dry. You know, they're trying to get their love needs met from one another and they're getting angry because they're not getting any place. They're working on limited resources. And so they, through misery then, they're driven further and further down, and then they try through marriage counseling and through this or that to try to recapture, oh, if we could just go back and do that first year over again. Or the first 5 years over again, first 10 years over again, and live that way. And somehow they would try to recapture what they had originally. Okay? But some point, say in here, they reach a point where, and these, let's just assume these are two believers and they said, okay, till death do us part. We're not divorcing, period. We're never ever going to get a divorce. When most people marry, they're not thinking about divorce. Most of the time. Okay? But they come to a point where they start thinking about it. This life is just too miserable. And so they basically see the door of what I call the marriage furnace. And the marriage furnace is where the heat goes up. And the heat gets turned up because the Lord is going to burn everything away that's not from Himself. He'll burn all that flesh away. And I like to use the example of Daniel chapter 3. Of my shack, your shack, and a bungalow. When King Nebuchadnezzar took him and was going to throw him in the fiery furnace, you remember what happened to the guys that threw him in? They were killed, yeah. And so, what their real names were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? And Abednego? Yeah, okay. That sounds pretty good here pretty soon. But those three guys, they threw him in. And then King Nebuchadnezzar looked in there and he said, who's that fourth guy? Remember that? So he looked in there, so he saw three little men walking around in the fire. Somehow they'd gotten loosed. And they saw a fourth guy in there that we come to recognize as a Christ figure. And what did it say that happened to those three guys when Nebuchadnezzar has come out? What remark was there about those three men? They didn't even smell like smoke. Nor were they singed at all. Now the guys that threw them in were killed because of the heat. Well, it's the same thing in the marriage furnace. As you two enter in, you have the protection of the Lord. You're not going to be destroyed. But I tell you what, it sure feels like destruction. It sure does. And to have an analogy within an analogy, when my wife and I were in South Africa, we went to a gold mine, and they took some of the impure gold and they put it in a crucible, and they fired it up pretty hot, and, you know, turned into molten gold. And all the slag or the sludge or the dross or whatever it was rose to the top, because gold is kind of a heavy, right? What do they call that? Heavy atomic weight? Has, you know, so it's heavier metal. And so the gold stayed at the bottom. So then they just took this little long stick and they poured off the dross, the slag or whatever you want to call it. They poured that off. And then they poured the gold out the other direction into a little thing that was the shape of a bar. So then they had another one that was cool, so you'd come over and hold $300,000 worth of gold, you know, and that kind of stuff, which is always kind of fun. And you make sure you don't put it in your pocket, you know, and you get in big trouble there if you do that. But it was interesting. Nobody in the crowd was over there looking on the ground, looking at all the dross that got poured off the top. Nobody was doing that. And that's what kind of this furnace does. With the Lord in the marriage furnace rises the dross to the top. And there are basically two ways of looking at dross. Number one, you can look at the dross and rationalize. In other words, these are reasons why we should divorce. Right? Look at all these problems we have. Or secondly, you can look at it at what God is fixing to fix. But either way, it's really not worth our attention, because it's the precious metal. That's what's good before the Lord. That's what He wants to see anyway. He's not really all that concerned about the dross. Just learn and deal with it. It'll make you miserable. But he's going to burn, you know, he's going to throw that away anyway. You don't need that kind of stuff. And so he tries to preserve, if you will, in this whole process, the preciousness of that marriage, which he views marriage very precious. And then we live more, if you will, if you can read the words before they dry, Christ-centered marriage up here, instead of a self-centered marriage over here. Okay? So, and here's what's really interesting. So many couples reach this point here then, and automatically this word comes up, divorce. They're thinking divorce. They're not thinking furnace. They're thinking divorce. Besides that, furnace equals work and pain and suffering. So, because they're lazy many times, they opt out and say, well, I'll just find me a new husband. So they ditch the bum and they get another bum. And what do? They're right back in the process again. Now, if it took them 8 years to get here this time, guess how many years it takes them to get there next time? That's right. Sometimes they get there and it's only 4 years. I was counseling with an individual who was on his 8th marriage. He was just about 40 years old, and it only took 3 months. That was his, you know, they'd find out what he was like in about 3 months, and then it was over, and he'd move on to something else. And so anyway, that was the process. So the thing is that, see, there are some lessons, and what I do is, if the flesh is still in control and I drag it right into the new marriage with me, what have I accomplished? Just a kind of a stay of execution. I get to prolong it for another 4, 5, 6, 8 years, something like that. And it took my wife and I about 7 years to basically reach this point, the furnace, where I basically said, I don't love her anymore. And the Lord said, good, now I can. And I said, you can? Well, I guess you can. And so then I began, you know, and it was not a fun year, that year that I came to that realization, but yet there was a sense of relief that, okay, you can love her through me, I guess. If you can, try it. But he did, and she did, and anyway, that was about, did it have something to do with 7-year itch? I don't know. You know, I'm just saying it just happened in 7 years with me. Okay? Yes. You always ask that question. Last time I was in a seminar, you asked that very same question, didn't you? Okay. Gee, I'm glad you said that, because I've got that written down here someplace. Marcin. It was because of Marcin. If you hear me on the tape, it's all because of Marcin. No. The inquiring mind. The requiring mind. Begin to see what my new identity in Christ is. Where does that new identity come from? Comes from Christ, doesn't it? And so immediately then I'm going to have to trust Christ, trust the Lord for that new identity. That comes with a relationship and looking to Him and trusting what He says about me, right? So immediately then we can begin to have a problem with what we call God concepts. How do we perceive God? And you know, just like we have a lot of the baggage of what I know I am and what I should be and all that kind of stuff, the feelings that I have versus, you know, I feel unloved, but I know that God loves me. Well, in the very same way, there's a sense where I take a particular guy here, like here. Well, he knows, we'll look at it a little bit more, he knows when I began to take him through this material, here's what happened. As he headed towards God, he began to realize, and this isn't in your book, by the way, but the God concept study is right there in section D. As he headed toward God, he began to realize that he felt at his worst, and this is not what's true, but what he felt at his worst, it was that God was hard to understand. I just don't totally understand God's ways. Not only was God hard to understand, but he was not understanding. So God was asking him to do things and not understanding how difficult it was for him to do those things. Not only that, then God was not compassionate because he was struggling with doing the things that God told him to do. And it seemed like God just put more pressure on. Then eventually he felt like God will eventually abandon you. Now you know that, you know, he knows this isn't right. He's just talking about feelings, okay? So God doesn't help you. He's hard to please. He's untruster. He'll neglect you. He's disappointed with you. He's hard to see. He doesn't love him. He'll reject me. And he puts me on a performance-based acceptance. What I do determines how loved I am. Now, part of where that comes from, where do you think all these characteristics come from? Okay, he's a good Bible student, so it sure didn't come from the Bible, did it? So as we begin to look at such critters in his life like his earthly father, who right shortly after he was born, he took off. Now, how hard is it to understand a father who's not there? Fairly difficult, wouldn't you say? That was not a very understanding thing for him to do, was it? To leave him in the lurch by himself? No. Was it very compassionate? No. Of course, that one is a direct application. I don't know if I've spelled it right, but it's a direct application. Abandonment. Huh? That is correct. Thank you. He doesn't help you, of course. A father who's not there doesn't help, does he? He's hard to please. See, I don't know what he wants, so it's hard to please if I don't understand what he wants. See, there's two senses to hard to please. I don't know what he wants, and his demands are too high. So they can both end up with the same thing. Of course, you can't trust one of those father figures. He will neglect you. He may be disappointed with you, so he left. Okay? All I'm trying to say here, then, is that many times the individual will project onto God the attributes of their earthly authority figure. It doesn't have to be dad. It'd be dad and mom and older brothers and sisters and those kinds of things. And that takes residence in the feelings. And so when I feel there's a thinking, if you want to look at it, take it backwards, what I feel about God, I think God is hard to understand, and there's a belief system that God's that way. Now that's all emotional. So as we've been examining it, a person has an emotional concept of who God is, as well as a mental concept of who God is. And one comes from experience, the other comes from knowledge. And of course, we know what is true about God. You know, He's trustworthy, He's personal, He's caring, He's loving, He wants the best for His children. He wants you to know the fruit of the fruit of the Spirit would be characteristics of God. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness. God is love, and love is 1 Corinthians 13. We can get some aspects of what God is like. God is all those things. So many times, so if this person has got to trust in their new identity, and they feel that God is like this, that's going to be a hindrance, don't you think? So anyway, that's what the section deals with, is then how do you remove this? And of course, the way you remove it, of course, is through faith. I should feel these ways about God as I approach Him, if that's been my experience. But it doesn't make them true. And so next time I pray and God doesn't seem to be there, that's when by faith you walk through and you say, God, Your word says You'll never leave me nor forsake me. Or You'll never desert me. You know, that doesn't mean that He's never going to serve dessert to you. It means He won't ever leave you. He's not going to just leave you in the lurch or abandon you. And so my faith then goes back here saying, God, You're not gone. I feel like You're gone, but You're not gone. Which brings us back to the other point, again, that I looked at last night, is that our feelings, many people live by their feelings, not by the truth. And in fact, right now the estimates are that over 80%, and most estimates are closer to 90%, of the decisions that we make every day are based on emotions, not on what we know to be the right way to do things. Now that's a scary thought, right? Because are emotions true? No. But somehow, our society says, if you violate your emotions, in other words, if you do something you don't feel like doing, then you're going to hurt yourself. That's harmful to you. That's what they say. So if a husband says to his wife, I love you, and he's doing it merely out of obedience, because the Lord told him to say that, or to do that, Is that going to harm him? No, that's obedience. But our society would say, no, because he didn't feel like it, that invalidated his love. See, so he couldn't say it until he really felt like it. Well, a person who says that lives by their emotions. That's all they live by. What if your emotions were lying? Well, if your emotions were lying, then you don't listen to them. You deny them. So if I know something that's true, and I act on truth, and my emotions don't fall in line, God calls that obedience. Satan calls it hypocrisy. Doing what I don't want to, I'm going against my emotions. I'm being a hypocrite. Now the only problem is most of us really don't live that way. When you got up this morning, did you feel like going to work? Or did you even feel like getting up? You know? And most of us deny our emotions all the time. So what if you went to work and at the end of the week you get your paycheck and it's for $5. You've worked 40 hours. And you said, what's the deal? And the guy says, well, you know, you only felt like working 15 minutes this week. So I'm just going to pay you according to what you felt. See, that's the only valid thing there is. So you were here and you felt like it for 15 minutes, so I'm just going to pay you $5. Well, it doesn't work that way. You're there, you do the job. And in fact, many times, if I act against my emotions, when they're lying emotions, if I act against them, it communicates more love. So I get up in the morning, and I really don't feel like reading the scriptures and praying and so forth and so on. It's going to be a busy morning. But I just kind of, you know, grab my coffee and head for my favorite chair and sit down and open my Bible and read a passage or two and begin praying to the Lord and stuff. And the Lord's looking down saying, well, you know, because you haven't felt like meeting with me this morning, I'm not going to receive anything or hear anything you say. Right? No, what's my motive? My motive is I need to know God. I don't care what my feelings say. So I'm going to go ahead and meet with the Lord. And feelings, if you'd like to come along for the ride, that's fine. But, you know, if not, tough cookies. You know, mind and will are going there anyway. And if you'd like to come along, fine. Otherwise, we'll see you in 15 minutes after we're done. And you head off to begin doing those things. And to be really honest, it's really healthy when we don't allow our emotions to lead us around anymore by the nose. Because many times they're lying emotions, and we'll see what that means. So that's what it talks about here, is that we have a concept of God that's based on emotion and one that's based on intellect. And the one that's based on emotion, you know, I'd say, okay, tomorrow morning when you get up, here's what you're going to meet with, a God that's hard to understand. He's not understanding of your situation, not compassionate, he's going to abandon you, doesn't help you, hard to please, untrustworthy, neglect you, disappointed with you, hard to see, not love you, and will reject you. Now, how excited are you going to be with meeting with that Lord? I'm going to say, excuse me, but no thanks. You know, I don't want to meet with a God like that. Or you go out and a friend of yours says, well, tell me about the Lord. Well, he's hard to understand. He's not compassionate. He's going to ban you, doesn't help you, hard to please, and he will eventually reject you. And you're going to say, great, you know, how do I sign up? What do I pray? Of course, you're not going to want to share God like that. And this, by the way, can be one of the reasons, if you've got a friend that you've shared the Lord with continually, this can be one of the reasons why they're not accepting the Lord. Because what they think they're getting is this. That's what they feel like they're getting. Instead of getting someone that's like this over here. Okay? So that section deals with, okay, now I've got to, I may have to struggle through a little bit of what God's like. So in that section in your book, you'll notice there's a bunch of diagrams. And the thing to do there is just to kind of work through the diagrams. These are some common emotional concepts of God, which are not true. It's really funny because I start reading through these and putting them up on the overhead, and some people, I have to stop in the middle and say, no, remember, these are not true. You know, because they're going, I always thought God was like that. What do you mean? I said, these are not true. So in D2 and D3 and page 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 of that section, one thing you can do is as you read through that, there's a number of statements under there, and you can kind of say, now what have I felt like at my worst, or felt when I didn't think that God was really paying attention to me? How have I felt? And then you've got some assignment there, and well, so how do I get through that? How do I get around that? Okay? So it's important to understand that. If I'm going to trust in what He says about me, I'm going to have to trust Him, aren't I? In order to trust what He says about me. So that becomes the next part. Now, then in section E, we look at the relational perceptions. What about those relationships? Okay, any question on concept of God? I'm just kind of running through it fairly quickly here. Pretty much understand what I'm saying? Okay. Some of the latest research shows that only 99.8% of believers have a mental and emotional concept of God that are significantly different. Only 99.8%. That only means 2 out of 1,000, it's the same. Okay? So we are dealing with some kind of a pretty significant interaction there. Sorry? Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought I did. But the feeling then, if I feel that God's hard to understand, it's because I think that God's hard to understand. There's a thought there. Okay, there is a thinking there. And then for Greg's belief system then, he believes that God is hard to understand. There's actual belief there, but it's of an emotional nature, but it is rooted in a belief system. And that belief system, by the way, has a major heading, and it's called deception. Okay? Now here's what's interesting, is that deception is embedded within his belief system that also holds the fact over here that God is trustworthy. See what I'm saying? So it's kind of an interesting phenomenon. One is overt, one's covert. One's under the surface, the other one's right on top. This is the one that's on top, though. See, he doesn't understand why every time someone says, trust God, there a knot goes in his stomach. You know, now he understands why. Because for him to trust God, it'd be like trusting his dad. And so he comes back and says, now wait a minute. God is my father, but God is not my earthly father who abandoned me when I was a kid. So he makes that distinction and he begins to identify those feelings and he can now put his faith in who God is.
So if I feel something that I
mm-hmm.
in my thinking makes an assumption about God and I act on that assumption as if it were true, that brings the truth of perception?
No, I'm working this backwards.
Okay,
because somewhere, see, his dad did abandon him. So the belief system was that this people called dads will abandon you. Which then, see, that was a thought in his belief system, which then manifests itself in a feeling. See what I'm saying? So I see how the arrows point to work itself down that direction. So what we do when we ask about feelings, we ask about feeling so we can work it backwards and get up to the belief system. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
So what you do about that is just say, I know that what I'm feeling is wrong, and I'm going to choose to act on what I know is right.
Exactly. Because, see, I'm denying lying emotions. They're lying. That's not truth. But I'm not denying that I have the feeling. See, the faith walk is almost always that way. I've got the feeling. God, I feel like you don't love me. But I know that's not true. Would you mind transforming my emotions to come in line with the truth? But instead, we say, God, I know I don't feel like you love me, so therefore I'm going to run out and get love from my husband or my wife or my kids or someplace else. Well, the second I start acting on it, it becomes stronger. Now you've got not only do you got the feeling of unlove, but now you've got an experience tied with it that doesn't meet your need. Now I'm starting to create idols to meet my love needs. See what I'm saying? So, in the beginning, it is kind of hard to step. Because your emotions, some of you have seen the little train illustration, Campus Crusade, you know, I shared that last night. There is a point in time when your emotions are changing where your mind is going one direction and the emotions are going the opposite direction. That's not easy. I don't even pretend that it's easy when you have to deny your emotions. Now, I really wish I could always say to my wife, I love you, and have the ushies gushies while I'm doing it. You know, that'd always be nice, but that's not always the case. I wish I could, clean up the kitchen and always feel right about doing it. Instead of maybe being put upon. But you know what? She still appreciates it anyway. That doesn't bother her at all. You know? Okay. And so, you know what I'm saying? So my feelings don't invalidate my action. I mean, they really don't. Because many times I'm denying myself and giving to someone else. And yeah, sometimes they understand that's what I'm doing, and sometimes it can actually make them feel bad that you're doing that. Right? Because you'd rather have it out of a motivation of love and, you know, want to do it. That's true. But we have to give individuals some time to change. Because we can't always do things out of the right feeling. So my question would always have to be, who said we had to do things out of the right feeling? Why do feelings invalidate what I do?
Because God loves a cheerful giver.
That's right.
Because he loves a reluctant giver.
Yeah. Huh?
Does God love a reluctant giver?
Well, you know, he loves all givers, doesn't he? And that's part of the motive, is that I'm giving. But see, well, what about a giver that's saying, you know, I really kind of rather hang on to this, but I would like to be cheerful in giving this. But my emotions aren't just not in it. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. It's like changing my thinking. Mm-hmm. Using reverse psychology.
I've always had trouble with that verse. But I had trouble with it because in college a girl broke up with me and she gave me that verse. And I said, and I thought, I don't think I would recommend anybody do that. It says, I want to break up with you, so consider it all joy. You know, you're going, yeah. Yeah, consider it all joy. Give me a break. Yeah, what a mean woman. I'm glad she dropped me. Now. Yeah, now it is joy. Now it is joy. At the time, it wasn't real. I had time reading that passage from then for about the next 5 years. But as you can tell, there's still a mental tag on that particular verse.
And the emotion is not all gone.
Well, it's pretty much all gone. I can look at it and laugh because she got hers. So no. I think she got married and divorced. No. Okay? So it is a real big thing with Christians as they begin to walk. And I'd like to share a little illustration. Maybe I should. You think? Okay. If I can find a clear piece of overhead. I think I've got one here, Bill. I had one here just a minute ago. See if you left your lights on. I think I've got one here. There's got to be one here someplace. Here it is. I got one, Bill. There's a point in time when you consider walking by faith versus walking by sight. We're going to look at two areas, mind and emotions. And we're going to contrast, if you will, the narrow way, walking by faith and sight. Now in the mind, then, here's some things that I know. That walking by faith imparts life. Granted? Walking by faith mentally, it's what I want. Okay? Walking by faith is secure. True or false? Okay? I mean, we know that to be true, right? Imparts life. It says, for I say, walk by faith, not by sight. So walking by faith imparts life. It's what I want, and it's secure. What about walking by sight then? Well, it imparts death then, if that's, it's just the opposite. Now death, let me define death here for a second. Death is weakness carried to an extreme. Okay? So in death, you get weaker and weaker and weaker until you finally, you not cease to exist, but your body becomes separated from life. Okay, the definition for death is separated. Separated from. Okay, and then, so it's death, we know that, and I don't want to walk that way. Or I just say not want, okay? That's not what I want. And it's insecure. Okay, intellectually, are we in agreement with that? Can you see where we get there? Now, when we first understand our identity in Christ and we first begin to walk by faith and not by sight, how does walking by sight feel? Does it feel like life or death? Well, I don't know about you, but for me, walking by faith, by sight felt like life. For some reason or other, when I was real needy, that piece of pizza really looked good. Or that woman really looked good, or whatever it was in my life. If I felt like I was dead on the inside, that I needed some excitement in my life, I wasn't thinking about faith. I was thinking about things, or something to meet my need. Okay? It felt like what I wanted. I wanted to meet that provision, not by faith, but by my own way. And it felt really secure. You know, when God says, I want you not to date that girl anymore, when I was in college, but I want you to date me. Boy, that's a real secure feeling, isn't it? Give up what you got for what? Well, we know for the Lord, well, that should be easy, right? It's not always that easy. So, emotionally then, at that period then, when I denied myself, it felt like death. I was going to die. It looked like somebody just ripped the cord out of my life. It felt like not what I wanted. And it felt pretty insecure. I'm not sure because I haven't walked a life of faith, so I don't know what to expect next. I've walked the sight walk a lot, but not the faith walk. Now, what needs to change in here? Does our mind need to change? No. In fact, the only thing that needs to change is this emotional column here needs to change places. Now, where do you think I spent the most time at the point where I had to make some of these decisions? Yeah, I spent the most time walking by sight, didn't I? So what's interesting is emotions will always follow where you spend the most time. So when you begin to walk by faith, the encouragement is to continue walk by faith, because the more time you spend there, the more secure, the more life it will feel like, and the more it will feel like what you want. Okay? Then can you imagine what it would be like if when temptation came along and you began to walk by sight, you felt insecure, like it's not what you wanted, it just didn't fit anymore? That'd be kind of exciting, wouldn't it? That is kind of exciting. Barbara? Where you spend most of your time, whether you're walking by sight or walking by faith. Now, let's go back to the illustrations then. Walking by sight, then, is one of the things it is living in lying emotions. See, lying emotions then are what's most comfortable. I feel worthless, unloved, everything else like this. And that's where I'm comfortable. That's where I've spent the most time. And walking by faith then is walking in truth. Okay? So there is a time element, and Mike likes to use this. He says, you know, you can expect to when the Lord really impresses you in the teaching of the abiding life and in Christ truths, or whatever you want to call it, takes 3 to 5 years to really walk out of it. It's not something you do quickly. It's because it's not something you do. It's more of a transformation. As I walk in truth, it continually goes, you know, it just kind of slowly moves along. And I can attest to that. It really does. I first started reading and studying and going through the training and stuff in 83. So it's been how many years? 11 years. Now, you know, I began to experience it here and there, but, you know, so you learn a lot of lessons in 11 years trying to just set your mind on the truth and walking that way. So anyway, it does take some time. Okay? Now, one of the things then, let's talk about relationships for a moment then. And we're going to get back to this person here. Remember the mess we looked at the other night? And we've got all these feelings of worthlessness, unacceptable, unwanted, so forth and so on, and some of the things that they did. And one of the things that, one of the little quizzes or tests, one thing that I did, and you really don't have this, but when a person comes in for counseling, I just give them this sheet, which is nothing more than you know, you've got item C here and item D and item E. Well, this is item C and item D and item E right here on there. And so I have them fill that out, and then when they come in, all I have to do is fill their thing out and explain it to them, and I'm pretty well finished. It's not all that difficult. See what I'm saying? But the one I want you to look at for a minute, and I want you just to spend a few minutes thinking on, is if you're married, I want you to look at this list down here, because we're going to start looking at this in terms of relationship. And I want you to try to pick out four, five, six of those that might describe your spousal unit at their worst. And write those down someplace. Okay? Or your person you're dating, if you're dating someone. Or the person you'd like to date. Or whatever. So I want you to try to pick out five, six, seven. Some of you may just say, can you Xerox that because that's what they're like, You may want to cross out the ones that aren't them, because they're all those things. But what do you feel about that person at their worst? It's not saying that's who they are. It's just saying they have those tendencies once in a while. So take about, it shouldn't take you 5 minutes. I'm just going to give a couple. No, just kind of what are they like at their worst? Okay, if you want to use it today, you remember the time frame. But if you want to go back, yeah, if you want to go back in the past on the way you see it and the person you see it, just remember that this was, if you have it, Satan's got it. See what I'm saying? So Satan's job is to steal, kill, and destroy, John 10:10. So a lot of times I encourage people, well, even at their worst, from however long you've known them, because if something happens, what am I going to throw in your face? Well, I'm going to throw that in your face. What's your spouse like at their worst? Okay? That's not to say that they're that way. That may just be 1% or 0.005% of the time. But I feel that way towards them, that when they're like that. This is what I feel towards them, okay? So I'm going to give you about 2 or 3 minutes. Just try to get at least 4 or 5 of those. And if you want to do it on... You're going to start relating these to the relational, what I call the relational filters. Now, if you're going to take notes on this, you need a sheet of paper, you need some fairly large circles like that, that you can be able to write words in. Now, here's what I want to kind of use as an illustrative type of a thing. And Bill, pass out a sheet of paper. If you want one, please raise your hand and he will do that and give it to you. These two filters, I want you to kind of, in your diagram, I want you to kind of put a little bit of a bridge between the two, just like they're spectacles like I have on my face. Okay? So these are the lenses through which I view my relationships. These are just two aspects of it. So just like in these spectacles, yours may be different, but mine distort the light as it comes in and moves it in such a way that my eye can perceive the light and so forth and so on. So it actually distorts the light. Now, my eye is actually the one that's distorted, right? The size and the shape and all that kind of stuff. But to some degree, this lens does distort the light that's coming in. Now, some of you are familiar with photography. If you take a red, what they call a red lens, a red filter, it's just a red piece of glass, and you stick it in front of your camera or over the lens, and you take a picture of a sunset, it changes the sunset. What is normally yellow is now kind of a brilliant orange. And it really is like one of those really colorful sunsets. It really looks nice. Now, the picture then that you get back, and you look at it and you think, man, what a great sunset. And it was a great sunset. But the picture has been distorted. The greens are greener. There's a number of different things. The color is distorted. Now, there's reality to the picture, though, isn't there? The tree is there. The mountains are there. That person's there. The dog is there. The grass is there. There's reality there. But there's a distortion there at the same time. So it's a distorted reality, if you will. It's got reality elements to it, and it's got distorted elements. Well, this is what our lenses are like. The lenses that we carry that have our perceptions in it. Now, you'll notice in the first column, I say is her self-perception. Okay? That is box C. That's your identity messages. You are at your worst. Unloved, unaccepted, unwanted, insecure, all these kinds of things. That's where you would put box C on your diagram. Okay? Then if you're a female type woman, you can, in this part, you'll say men are, and that's when you'll put the descriptors that we've just got done looking at. Okay? And so that's how you'll fill that part out. You put that in this column. Now, if you're a male type person, then you put your, of course, you put box C in here for you, and then you put your descriptors for what women are like at their worst in that column. Okay? Now, what you do in these little boxes down here is you put box E. So that for both of you, you put box E. So if you're going to do some marriage work on stuff, marriage work as we call it, then you both should have a page where you have your spousal units, descriptors, and their box C written in these columns too. See what I'm saying? So you can see the whole picture one fell swoop. Let me put up, I think last night I showed you a diagram of how absolutely complicated it can look, and I probably put it away. Oh, here it is. See, that's what it... Whoops, it's upside backwards. You know, that's what it can look like. See how this box sees men are, women are, how the identity message here, women are, men are. Well, that's one thing that we're going to do essentially the same thing, but it's going to be a little bit cleaner so you can see it, okay, on this right here. We're doing the very same thing. Okay, you see, you understand what to do with this now? So now I'm going to start filling in. I'm not going to ask you to share yours, but what I am is going to give you some common ones that I run into. Okay? And what you'll find is a lot of times a lot of the elements are the same. So you've got a woman here whose self-perception is that she's unloved, unaccepted, unholy, impatient, worthless, failure, guilty, stupid, and boring. At her worst. She's not that way all the time, of course, but at her worst. That's the way she feels about herself. It's not true about her, but that's how the way she feels. She feels that men are, at their worst, insensitive, selfish, controlling, demanding, hard to please, unkind, untrustworthy, and inconsistent. Okay? And he does... The male, then, he feels unloved, unaccepted, unholy, impatient, worthless, failed, guilty, stupid, boring. In other words, he feels just like she does. Well, you'll find a lot of the same elements, by the way, in both of the images. Then, but for him, women are insensitive, selfish, controlling, demanding, hard to please, irrational, untrustworthy, inconsistent, and emotional. So there's a few different ones, but pretty much the same thing. Now, these men are and women are definitely are different. Not in particularly this diagram, but what if you were raised in a family where dad always was a couch potato, sat and watched TV and didn't talk to you? Well, you might still get in the same things, insensitive, selfish, but you may not get controlling or demanding. That may not be in there. Instead, it could be passive and distant. See what I'm saying? See, depending upon your connection with, for her, for male type people, then that will definitely determine what's in their box. Now, if you've had if one of your parents have cheated on the other one, so you're a little girl and dad cheated on mom, you'll have in here, you know, he'll cheat on you. That's a common one that you'll find in these kind of filters. Now, if a little girl has the idea that men will cheat on you, then when she gets married, what does she do? She drags that right into marriage with her. Right? And so next thing you know, she's looking for her husband to cheat on her. Now that's just, it seems pretty irrational, but yet it seems pretty natural. Because for her, that's what men do. That's what men are. Okay, you with me so far? How these things can change? Okay, now we're going to take that back to the first one. We have the same descriptors now, but this time we've added the boxes down there. That was box E, what we do at our worst. And I want to begin to show you now what begins to happen and how this all works together in a relationship that's coming apart. Okay? Let's say that this fella comes home and he's had a hard day at work, and he comes home and it has everything to do with work, and he's totally moody, kind of irritable. Okay? That's just an assumption. We got to start someplace. So he's kind of moody, and she, all of a sudden, his moodiness, his actions then hit that first filter that men are. Now, if your name was Satan and your job description was to steal, kill, and destroy, which one of those buttons are you going to push? Let's say each one of those words is a button. What are you going to push? This is, by the way, I'm not just asking the question. Give me some feedback. What button are you going to push and why? So this guy's moody. But he doesn't tell her why. Okay. He's selfish. Why is he selfish? Not being nice? Just thinking of his own self? Doesn't want to be bothered? Okay. So she's thinking, boy, this guy's selfish. What else? Insensitive? Okay, because she's had a hard day too, hasn't she? So he's rather insensitive. When a person's moody, what are they trying to do, generally speaking? They're trying to move you away by controlling, aren't they, or manipulating you? So here they are trying to control or manipulate you to treat them a particular way. So there's control there. A person moody is a person that's moody, hard to please, generally speaking, because you're not necessarily that. Being moody is probably not real the kindest thing to do, especially at the end of a long day, is it? I mean, you don't know what's going on. Okay, so you see how some of these buttons automatically, you see, I already gave you the scenario. He's moody because of something that happened at work, but he's not a talker. She's already picking up that it's confirming some things that she may have felt like what he is at his worst. Now let's say then how does she interpret that then towards herself? If he's moody, what does that say about her? Okay. So she's worthless, isn't she? He doesn't care enough to express himself. Maybe he's moody because she's a failure. Maybe she starts feeling she's taking on that guilt. She starts feeling guilty. Now she's stupid because she doesn't even know what it is that he's moody about. See what I'm saying? So all of a sudden she's getting all these identity messages here because he's acting that way. So then she runs to her little box of tricks and she says, well, I'm going to show him. I'm going to withdraw. I'm going to withhold myself from him mentally, emotionally, physically, or spiritually, or all the above. I'm going to withhold myself from him. I'm not going to let him. I'm going to punish him by standing back and not giving him any attention. Okay, not treating him nice. But this one is a run. I'm going to get away. Now she runs away, and what does it communicate to him? Let's see if this works better. No. Let's see if this works better. What's it communicate to him? Let's look at the possible things that what does that confirm about his belief about women? Okay, they're hard to please. Demanding, right? Emotional. Irrational. Okay.
Insensitive
to their needs and everything. Really selfish, because all they want to do is for him to always be nice, and she doesn't care about what's going on in my life, right? Now you see how even just a simple misunderstanding now has got us pretty messed up already, right? Not only that then, if she's this way, but what's it say about him? Well, he's disrespected. If she's withdrawing, she sure doesn't love me and accept me. I must really be worthless. I'm a failure as a husband. I'm pretty stupid because I can't even figure out what's going on here. Right? So the next thing you know, he's into his bag of tricks here. So he says, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to leave. So he gets his coat on and he takes off. Now, what did he disprove to her?